House Ways and Means Committee has come to order. It is January 28th, 2004. President Representative Samuels, Representative Wilson, Representative Moses, and myself, Representative Wyrock. And Peggy, we just noted your attendance. Today, what we're going to do are basically three things. We wanted to make sure the Department of Revenue had completed its overview topics that it had basically started last time. Second, that the department will talk about the bond sale that occurred, I think, yesterday?
Tuesday.
And, oh, it's 2005. I do that on my checkbook, too. And then third, we wanted to start the process of talking about oil tax policy, the economic limit factor, the administrative order that the administration had just come out with, and the contours on that that occurred, I think, yesterday that I read about. And to try and get a fundamental understanding of what that means. In an overview sense, not with any specific provision before us. So that's where we are. And so why don't we begin however the department wants to proceed. And we have Commissioner Corbis and Deputy Commissioner Boutin.
And we should have Anchorage on the phone.
Yeah.
Oh, Dan Dickinson's online. We need a bigger table, too, don't we? Jerry Brunette, Special Assistant, and the economist.
Fred Freed.
Mr. Freed. Okay.
Why don't we
Absolutely. Haul him on up.
Come on. See when it's really on or not.
Okay. Brad.
So just let us know.
I need these.
Okay. Johanna Bales is on Johanna Bales is, it may or may not be online and may or may not testify. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, this is Dan Dickinson with Johanna. We are both here in Anchorage.
Okay, thanks a lot. Commissioner, thanks again for coming.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. My name is Bill Corbis, Commissioner of Revenue. You've taken the wind out of my sails. I was going to introduce all my distinguished colleagues, but they're all present and accounted for, and thank you. We were going to review reiterate the structural deficit that we discussed at the meeting on January 14th. We're going to describe to you the administration's solution for the structural deficit. Then Tom Buchanan is going to talk about the recent very successful bond sale we had. And then finally, Dan Dickinson is going to talk about the existing oil and gas structure, including ELF. In regards to the structural deficit, I guess I just would like to make it clear that the department, the deficit has two aspects of it, the revenue side and the spending side. And others in this administration are much more qualified to talk about the spending side of it. So in our presentations in the revenue forecast books, we just always say that if our spending level is 2.3 billion or 2.4 billion or whatever, that assuming that kind of spending, that the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund will run out at such and such a date.
I guess it's an interesting little role that this committee is going to take on. We may be like a Greek chorus or a gang of muses who are the only ones that are going to chant deficit, deficit, future problem, recurring sources of revenues, long-term concerns, and whether anyone in the main cast of characters listens is then the concern I have. I mean, I what we read about in the budget books that are presented to us by the legislative budget folks is that short term, we're going to have another deficit. And so beyond this year, we're going to be in where we were two and a half years ago. And making that reality something that's tangible in the public's mind and in the legislature's mind may be the role we play. And so I really do see the role of this committee as continuing where we were for the past 2 years and trying to grasp the problem, educate ourselves and the public on the problem, that it still exists, it hasn't gone away, and the need to do something about it.
Mr. Chairman, we thank you for the role that you see this committee playing, and we think it's needed, and we are in complete agreement.
Okay.
At the meeting on January 14th, we reviewed with you the state's long-term or the state's financial situation in three time frames: the short term, the long term, and the very long term. We said the short term, which is fiscal year 05, things look good, but long term, things don't look so good. And for the very long term, that's after the gas pipeline, ANWR, some future oil production initiatives under consideration, when they come online, things should be good again. In the fall revenue forecast, we handed out to you table 2.8, or we brought to your attention table 2.8, which should be in front of you, which pretty clearly points out what the future holds as far as the deficit goes. This is this projection is assumes a 2.33 billion dollar budget that the administration has introduced for 06 is adopted, and that remains at that level for the future, and that the oil prices that we our projections that were described to you actually are realized. Then we also discussed with you table 2.9 from the fall revenue forecast that shows when the constitutional budget reserve will run dry under various levels of spending and various prices of oil. Your particular attention is directed to the third column from the right, which is based on the price of oil contained in the fall 2004 forecast, and it so that it would suggest that that the constitutional budget reserve would run out in February of 2011. We then pointed out to you that that the governor has made the statement, it's this administration's position that we're not going to let the constitutional budget reserve fall below $1 billion. And if that's the case, that we would be looking at hitting that $1 billion mark at in May of 2009. Now, this is the following page is a table that was not discussed, or it's a figure that was not discussed at the January 14th meeting. This comes from the fall 2003 forecast. And I apologize that the it's very hard to read what the symbols or the different colors on the graph means. But what we're trying to illustrate here is that eventually that the gas pipeline, that ANWR, that some initiatives in the NPRA, Beaufort Sea, and further developments in the central North Slope satellites will come online. And what we'll call that the very long-term picture. And what we're trying to do, what the strategy is to bridge the gap between now and then. And the numbers in this graph are old, and the dates when these developments will come online is uncertain. But that's the point is, though, that we believe that eventually these activities will occur, and there will be a significant increase in revenues at that time. And that is what we call entering the very long term, and that we should be looking for better times coming. So that is the overall strategy. Now, what is the solution for the just the long term, between that's the period between say 2006 and 2011, 2012, 13, 14. First of all, as we discussed at the last meeting, and as most of you or all of you are familiar with the last session, the administration strongly supported the POMV, the use of some of the permanent fund to help pay for the cost of government. I don't know what more the administration could have done to have more forcefully put forth its position on it. As it turns out, the legislature adopted not to go forward with it. Point out to the legislature, to the committee, that as far as the administration is concerned, the POMV is still on the table. We invite you to re-examine it. If you have a way that you can make the POMV a better mechanism to bring forward, we're certainly interested in hearing it. If there is another proposal to access the permanent fund to help pay for the cost of government, we certainly would welcome hearing from you. We'd like to point out to you that the permanent fund puts out a monthly projection as to what the realized earnings reserve is going to be at the end of each year for the next, I think it's next 10 years, and that for the end of fiscal year 05, after paying dividends and after inflation proofing, that at the 50% confidence level, from a probability perspective, that we're looking at a $2.1 billion level of the realized earnings reserve of the permanent fund.
As of what date would that be?
That would be as of June 30th of this year.
2005.
2005.
$2.1
billion? $2.1
billion.
Chairman.
Oh, President Representative Roekberg, Representative Seaton, and Representative Gruenberg joined us. Representative Roekberg.
Mr. Chair, Commissioner, that would be net of any payment for the dividend inflation proofing for calendar 05?
That would be after.
Right. Okay.
So the mechanism that you allude to, if POMV is not in place as a structural tool to use, the mechanism already exists to use portion or all of the $2.1 billion simply by a political vote of 51% of the legislature.
Yes. So that is one, or the primary thrust of the administration's solution to our fiscal problem. The governor, in his January 13, 2004, State of the State address, outlined a 5-point financial plan to get us through this period. Fiscal discipline, resource development, enhancement of non-petroleum revenues, in other words, those who benefit from the state pay for the cost of the benefits they receive, and the finally that the local governments pay for the services they provide. Now let me just briefly adjust oil revenues policy on oil revenues.
Commissioner, those were the points the governor made a year ago, roughly.
That's right.
And those are still the general philosophical
That's
framework.
Still the general philosophical framework. This administration goal, as far as oil revenues go, is that we are interested in increasing production on the North Slope. We want to see the oil pipelines, the TAPS pipeline, being operated at full capacity. Right now it's only operating at about 50% capacity. So we have suggested to the legislature, we have suggested to the industry that that if they have proposals to modify the existing oil and gas tax regime, we would certainly be willing to, we would welcome such discussions. We are looking for incentives, tax incentives, to encourage that development looking to the future.
Commissioner, I just have a question here. Are you suggesting maybe something like a tax if the pipeline isn't full or something like that? I mean, I'll go into that a little bit.
Through the chair, Representative Wilson, no, we're suggesting that it, we're taking the carrot approach rather than the stick approach, and that we're trying to find incentives or to modify the oil regime that will encourage investment so that production will increase.
That'll statement we want to come back and haunt you with, because we too want incentives to maximize private sector investment and development of the resource, particularly in the oil and oil sector, while optimizing the return of the state's coffers of revenue. So revisit that as it pertains to the administrative order later on, and help whether that carrot is being used as a stick to provide the incentives to fill the pipeline. But so I didn't want to lose that thought, but go ahead, Commissioner.
Okay, finally, as far as non-petroleum revenues go, it makes up about 15% of our revenue base. We have, during the last two previous years, suggested enhancement to various taxes in that base, which were some of which were adopted by the legislature, some of which were not. At this time, there are no proposals on the table from the administration for changes there. I would point out, however, that we are examining in-house alcohol taxes and license fees, as well as non-petroleum corporate income taxes, looking for possible reforms in that area, and that the legislature may hear from us later on those two subjects. And that completes my my comments, Mr. Chairman.
Committee? Thanks, Commissioner. Representative Roper.
Chairman, Mr. Commissioner, I take it you are aware of the history of the alcohol taxation issues in the state of Alaska, whereas I believe the 22nd legislature took that issue up and I believe raised the alcohol taxes across the board to what I believe to be the highest in the United States. Can you tell the committee why you would be re-examining that issue so shortly after we'd already taken that issue up?
Through the chair, Representative Rochberg, we're examining the issue because the cost of alcoholism to the state is substantially greater than the revenues that we're receiving from alcohol taxes.
Representative Grunberg.
But isn't that true with other industries, too?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, yes, that's true of many other industries.
May I continue?
Yes.
Well, if you're going to be consistent, why not be consistent and use that same philosophy with the other industries in which that's true?
Through the chair, Representative Grunberg, we have tried on various industries in the last several sessions, and that was not always well received by the legislature. We have not addressed alcohol taxes during this administration as of yet, and so we'll see.
I would hope that that wouldn't be the only reason you wouldn't look at being consistent, because it seems to me that that there are a number of industries in which we have given a lot more tax breaks than we have to the hospitality industry, and we have not gotten much from that. Jobs, to some extent, but not the sustainable revenue that this state needs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just kind of mystified by this, and the commissioner lends some light on it, because I believe he makes the statement rather clearly that the rationale for looking into this really comes from a desire to impact the cost of delivering health services to the citizens of Alaska that qualify under the state umbrella. And it sounds like this is an issue that would be emanating from the Department of Health and Social Services rather than the Department of Revenue. So, albeit I understand that the Department of Revenue is the, you're charged with developing taxation policies and collections. But, Mr. Commissioner, I have my revenue forecast book here. Could you direct me to where we're collecting these sin taxes in here so I can see where we're at? You know what page that's on?
Through the chair, I'm going to let Mr. Freed answer this question.
Representative Ruffer, if you check on page 41.
And, Mr. Chairman, if I might, the...
For the record, that's other taxes, unrestricted corporate fish, cigarette, and alcohol, but fishing is not a sin, at least, but this includes...
Maybe an addiction, though.
Mr. Chairman, looking at the page, we have the unrestricted, and '04 was $9.4 million, and restricted $16.3.
Sorry, Representative Roper, it's the $16.3 right there.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, right. I was looking at our other sin tax there. And you're projecting a decrease because of the recent... Is there a reason the projections in '05 are lower than '04?
Through the chair, Representative Roper, the only reason they're actually level, but we changed the method of accrual, so there's an actual, there's an extra 15 days in there, but we're projecting them as level.
Well, if I might follow up, Mr. Chairman, then with the apparent objective to socially engineer less alcohol consumption, what levels are you reviewing to try to make an impact?
Through the chair, Representative Roberg. I've just stated that the administration is looking into this. We're not in any position to defend anything at this time.
Well, if I could just follow up, Mr. Chairman, have you, well, by just taking a cursory look, have you looked at any other jurisdictions to see what levels you have to reach to have a social impact? Are we talking about 100%, 50%, or what? What kind of studies, do you have access to studies that show what direction you might be heading?
Through the chair, Representative Roberg, we are analyzing a number of factors here. We're not prepared to make a statement on this issue at this time. All I can say is that I pointed out that these are alcohol taxes and non-corporate non-petroleum corporate income taxes are a couple of areas that we're looking at where we want to make sure that these constituencies are paying their fair share of the load.
Mr. Chairman, shifting over to your other area here, the non-corporate taxes, would this take the nature of looking at subchapter S corporations, LLCs, LLPs, and other limited partnership types of business organization, or is that what you're referring to, or is there some other area you're examining?
Through the chair, Representative Roberg. We have taken a look at the subchapter S. We've looking at tax loss carry forward, carry back provisions. We're looking at interest paid on non-paid taxes, tax refunds. We're looking at approval of federal income tax credits. And a number of other things. Again, we're just looking and not in any position to go any further than that, to defend anything.
There's no proposal before the
legislature. There is no proposal.
This is you're articulating what some of the brainstorming is going on internally. Representative Roper, did you follow up with Representative Samuels?
No, I'll let him off the hook for now.
All right. Representative Samuels and Groomberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll follow up on what Representative Roper said. As your discussions internally are going down the road, one question, just real briefly on the alcohol tax, is one question that I will ask if a proposal is brought forward, and I know you don't have a position right now, is the goal to have a social change where people drink less, or is the goal simply to collect money from those people that that are the problem causers, or if you blame alcohol or blame the individuals, is it to collect more money or is it to enact a change? And that would be kind of a philosophical question that I will be asking if the proposal moves forward. Secondly, on the taxes on S-Corps and LLCs, do you have a time frame on when you will decide to go forward with the proposal or not go forward? I mean, are you into the details of the discussions internally? And I don't want to get into the merits of the discussion, but are we going to see this in the next month or in the next session, or a decision not to move forward with the administration on either of these proposals? Are you in the very elementary phases and you don't know a time frame yet, or are you kind of getting down to the details?
Through the chair, Representative Samuels, in regard to your first question about alcohol taxes, we in the Department of Revenue have been looking at it from a revenue perspective. There are other perspectives, as you brought up, and I'm just not in a position to comment on that. In regard to time frames, no, we do not have any time frames to suggest at this time.
Okay, thank you.
Let's see, Representative Broomberg.
That was going to be my question.
Exactly.
You know, we're in the third year of the administration, and we've been hearing, with all due respect, we're looking at this now for some 3 years. Time's getting short.
Well, the committee has had before it bills related to corporate taxes. We've gone through the process of reviewing those on several meetings. Committee, I don't think, took actions historically. Again, it's a way to manage the process in part, because what is easy for the political rhetoric to say, we need to have everything on the table, and you hear that all the time. And so getting things on the table is one thing, enacting them into law is quite a different matter, because of the political contours of the debate on and the sensitivity of industry reaction to the proposals. It's somewhat difficult to do that unless they feel everyone's touched equally. And finding that balance has always been the trick. So, and that would be the objective of the committee, I hope, is to try and get those revenue proposals moving in a way that's fair and equitable and at least thoroughly discussed so that people feel that it's on the table and being discussed and moving forward to address the problem. And whether the goal of the tax is a social engineering one or a revenue one, I understand your role is to analyze the revenue impacts, not necessarily the social ones. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with your comments.
Okay. Let's see, Representative Seaton.
Thank you. You said that revenue's goal was to, or the administration's goal was to, look at everybody to contribute kind of equally and make sure that, or not equally necessarily, but at least to pay their fair share. And the administration come forward with the wildlife viewing tax proposal. I don't believe I've seen anything of that. There are two proposals, I know, bills in the House to put a tax on the cruise industry. And I'm wondering, has the administration taken a position on those yet? Those aren't in, for some reason, in Ways and Means, they're in CRA. But I was wondering whether the administration has looked at that, at those proposals, and has taken any position.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, during the last two sessions of the legislature, the administration was successful in getting four general taxes adjusted or installed: the studded tire tax, car rental tax, tobacco tax increase, an increase in business license fees. We also proposed increases in gaming taxes, a seasonal sales tax, an increase in the motor fuel tax, and the visitor tax package. The latter four were not the legislature chose not to proceed with those. At this juncture, I am not aware of anything in the visitor industry. At least we're not doing any work on it in-house.
Okay.
Yeah.
And to follow up on a different point, I'm trying to get a little bit of a handle on the different tax streams we have, or different tax scenarios we have for different industries. You have the production tax and oil tax, which is basically a gross extraction tax. And we have in the fisheries business tax, which is basically a gross extraction tax as well, although it's on a renewable resource. It's at 3%. Broadly, there's a credit down to 1% for a developing or underdeveloped fishery, and there's a 5% if it's on a floating. But that's a gross initial tax on the gross value initially harvested. And I'm wondering about on mining. We have a lot of mining going on. My understanding is that the taxes that we're doing on mining industry are on the net value instead of on the gross value of the resources being extracted. And it seems to be on a very different plane from what we do on oil and what we do on fish. And so I'm wondering if there's been any analysis on that and the reasons for that.
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, we would suggest to the chairman, to the committee, that there probably should be a session devoted to non-petroleum taxes, which could take a full session and give you a complete run through of all these taxes and answer those questions. We could answer that today, but we have a big program in front of us yet.
We plan to do that. We wanted to start segue into the taxes, starting with oil taxes at this meeting, and then get into the ones that Representative Seaton discussed. I wanted to get we have roughly 104 days left in the session, and these overview sessions are somewhat helpful because at least we try and read the tea leaves on what we might expect in terms of proposals from the executive branch. And I get the sense that the executive branch is willing to look at initiatives coming from the legislature, but we may not necessarily see something introduced by the executive branch. And is that sentiment, do you generally agree with that sentiment?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we agree with that.
Okay. So if the Ways and Means Committee and or the people of the state of Alaska want to see a full range of revenue measures on the table, it's incumbent upon the legislative branch to introduce those proposals for discussion and the administration's reaction. Do you agree with that?
Yes.
Okay. So we'll see where that takes us.
Right. Thank you.
Representative Greenberg.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is kind of like Alphonse and Gaston. Everybody wants the other guy to go through the door first. Maybe rather than doing that approach, we should see what we can do together. And if it's that one branch is only willing to look at the situation, if the other guy goes first, then likely nothing will get done. And I'm not just talking about this particular problem, but I'm talking about leadership in government generally, that we're elected to provide leadership. Both branches, we're equal. Neither can escape its responsibility. And the people of this state and every other state and every population generally, I suppose, expect the government to lead. They're not going to worry about which one goes first. And I would hope that generally the legislature around here anyway traditionally seems to be more reactive than proactive. We have a strong strong governor under the Constitution. And we traditionally look to the executive branch for leadership and planning, and that's what we've come to expect. But certainly, to throw all the responsibility on the legislative branch is pretty tough, and I'm wondering if you and the executive branch would be willing to reconsider that now you only want to be reactive, at least in this area.
Well, through the chair, Representative Gruenberg, I guess if you look at this history, the history of this administration, I don't consider us to be reactive. If you look what we have done in the last two sessions, and we're willing to work with you and sit down and discuss any proposals you have. As I mentioned, we are looking at a couple of proposals ourselves. We're not in a position to make a statement today or make a move today, I guess. But
well, Commissioner, let me just pick up for Representative Gruenberg. I'm not timid about introducing the proposals to spur the debate and discussion. And now that I understand where you're coming from, we're gonna do something. I just need to talk with the committee to see where we can go and the best way to formulate the approach. Because the House has historically been the ones to step up and take responsibility for lots of revenue measures and has actively done things to promote the state's long-term fiscal health. And I don't see us sitting on our laurels waiting for somebody else to do something. So we're gonna act. I just wanna know the framework in which we're gonna be acting. So I appreciate your candor, and Representative Gruenberg, we will talk about the mechanism that we'll use to move, because that's what I plan to do. I don't want to waste time. Anything else on that topic?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I'd like to turn it over to Tom Buchanan, who's going to tell us about our most recent bond issue.
When you talk about the bonds, Mr. Buchanan, thank you for being here. There's a couple other aspects, if you could segue into after you talk about the historic recent bond sales, bonds in general, and then whether the state's in a position to do a mini Garvey or a major Garvey, because that certainly is an option for the legislature to consider this session. And then if you'll define those terms for the public too.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, and gosh, I'm going to try to just take a little bit of time. Dan Dickinson has a presentation, you know, prepared.
Let's see, we're scheduled to last till when? 10 o'clock.
For you, and I do tend to be long-winded, and also, if I could just kind of beg your forbearance and sort of segue into talking about the state's credit, kind of touch on the conversation with Representative Gruenberg that just ended. I have to tell you that I talk to credit analysts a lot and investment banking firms a lot, at least recently in the context of this bond sale we had this week. And from the perspective that I think those people have, I think this governor has shown the kind of leadership that they were hoping to see for a great long time. And I think our credit ratings and the recent action by Moody's Investors Service is a direct result of that. And I think if you talk to credit rating analysts, they'll tell you that they've seen more progress in the gas line, progress they were hoping to see for a long time. I mean, we all know the gas line's been talked about for decades. That they've seen more progress in the last couple of years in the gas line than they've seen in the since statehood until now. And likewise, some of the fiscal policies and fiscal restraint and fiscal management that they cite in the rating report. You can read it, and actually I distributed it the last time revenue was here. I think from the investment banking community and the credit rating analyst perspective, and they've used the words leadership in talking to us, and so from their perspective, at least, they from their view, and they read papers online every day, the Alaska papers. I think their perspective is they've seen the kind of leadership they were hoping to see for quite a while. And of course, the new tax proposals and the Conference of Alaskans, of course, Standard & Poor's attended and was a participant in the Conference of Alaskans, and then the efforts for POMV. The people I talk to see that as leadership. Not every initiative is successful, of course, but it's a government and everybody gets their say. And but they sure see this administration as trying very, very hard to come up with a fiscal solution and to use both debt management and fiscal management, the kind that they like to see, and they do cite that. So anyway, that's thank you for
committee. Please, if you don't mind, Mr. Boutan, yeah. As questions come up, we're just going to interrupt you. So
sure.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, because interest rates have continued to fall, the state bond committee earlier this week was able to refinance about a third of the outstanding lease debt, and it was a competitive sale. I guess the remarkable things about it, if there were remarkable things, it was a complicated little financing, and I think some issuers would have used a negotiated method of sale as a result, but the State Bond Committee decided to use a competitive sale over the internet, and I think reflecting some of the interest that the investment bankers have in what's going on in Alaska, there was a record number of bidders, 10 bidders, and the final maturity of the debt that we issued, the new bonds, is 2013, and the true interest cost, the winning bid of those 10 bidders, they bid a true interest cost of 3.1025%. So it saves the state in debt service about $136 million a year. Net present value savings of about 3.6%, and in refundings, the net present value savings is one of the measures. The underwriter spread was only $1.60 a bond, and I've seen state issuers quite recently with underwriting spreads as high as $9, sometimes maybe even a little bit higher. That really is all I wanted to say. All I thought that I should say about this particular debt issue. It was very successful, and both in terms of number of bidders and in the aggressiveness of the bidding. The credit rating agencies reviewed all the state's debt in the context of reviewing this debt and did write-ups, and I provided those write-ups to you earlier. So I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Questions, Mr. McCann? Yeah, Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Boutan, I'm looking at your handout here. It's very helpful, but I'm trying to determine you said of a third of the outstanding COP. What was the corpus amount, and what was the total amount of the refi, and what's outstanding, what's the interest rates, and are there multiple tranches on most of these underwritings, too?
Well, try to answer all of those. On 6/30/2004, there was $72 million of lease debt outstanding. We advertised this at $27.2 million, but the way the bid came in, and with refunding debt, and this is part of the reason why many issuers use a negotiated sale instead of a competitive sale, we reserved the right to gross up or down depending on the bid. So. Given the nature of the bid, that is a very aggressive bid. We grossed it down, and so it turned out to be, in the end, $25,725,000 outstanding. So I guess it sort of reduced the amount of lease debt the state has outstanding by a couple of million dollars. I don't want to put too fine a point on that. We allowed premium bond bids, and that might get into more technicalities than you care to have. I don't have with me debt service to maturity for all of the state's debt. I sure can provide that, but I didn't happen to bring that volume of information.
Talking about the refi, the tranches on refi, are they all maturing in 13?
We refinanced it with level debt service. We refinanced four different projects, and the wildfire facility out in Palmer, the Fairbanks Courthouse, the maintenance facility in Soldotna, and the health lab in Anchorage. So we refinanced it with level debt service out to 2013.
And are these tax exempt instruments?
Yes, they sure are. They're public purpose, and of course the debt we refinanced was also tax exempt. In this refunding, it's called a current refunding because all the bonds are callable. The Internal Revenue Code has some severe restrictions on refinancing debt that isn't yet callable. These bonds were all callable. Now they were not a year ago. We were waiting until these became callable.
Are the new issues callable?
No, they're not. We made a decision to go for the gusto and get the lowest true interest cost we could, since it's pretty short final maturity of just 2013. Mm-hmm. And so given that, we thought that we would get a lower true interest cost by having them non-callable. And also, given where we are in the interest rate environment, what's the likelihood that interest rates are going to fall enough again from current levels to make a call feature on these bonds worth taking a bit of a true interest cost hit? That's kind of the rationale that we had. So, no, these new bonds are not callable.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just follow up.
Rookberg, go ahead.
Unless there's anybody else. Mr. Padilla, could you tell the committee where, from a kind of a global perspective on our debt financing right now, how much of an opportunity do we have to do any more refinancing of it in the near term in the historic context of the lower interest rates over the last few years and the prospects of rising rates in 2005 and beyond? I mean, do we have an opportunity to try to lock in some of these lower rates? And I want to congratulate you. It looks like this is a very successful sale. What, if any, opportunities do we have to look forward to in terms of refinancing or coming to the market if, in fact, the legislature authorizes any bonds in this current legislative cycle for the 06 capital budget, for example? How long has that taken? Can we try to move it rapidly to capture some lower rates before they start accelerating upwards, which short-term rates already have?
Well, let me see. That
long question. Sorry, too much.
Yeah, that's okay, for sure. The GO bonds that the state issued in April of 2003, we're watching pretty closely because the yield curve is flattened and some of those maturities could come into the money for refinancing to kind of give you an idea of where interest rates have gone since 2003, which doesn't seem like a long time ago. There's one state lease deal that was done through a municipality a few years ago, and that's now in the money. Because it was done through a municipality as the issuer, we have to negotiate. They probably won't accept a competitive sale. They'll probably insist on a negotiated sale, and there's some negotiations that go on when state debt is issued through a municipality rather than through the state bond committee, as this debt was. So there's one lease financing right now that's definitely in the money, and we'll be doing that. We constantly look for refinancing opportunities as brought about by the interplay of call features and lower interest rates. As far as where interest rates will be a year from now, I don't know. In Treasury, we've been keeping our durations on the short side compared to the aggregates that we're benchmarked against because we just really are not sure where, and that's been very successful, by the way. We've been beating the average. So I don't know. We're really not market timers, and so as refinancing opportunities come about, we take advantage of them.
Mr. Chairman, just to follow up, and there was an earlier question about the potentiality of Garvey bonds, and to follow up on the other part of my protracted question was, looking at the current budget cycle, and for example, the governor's transportation capital budget, using AMROT has or whatever format, going to the bond market, is there ways that we can expedite that? Or is there any timing issues that we need to be aware of? Were we to authorize that would help capture rates in a rising market? And what is the scope of that, and what do they look like?
Well, Garvey bonds are a special provision in federal law that allow issuers to issue debt that's 90% dependent upon expected federal transportation receipts, and $102 million of the almost half a billion dollars, $463 million of general obligation bonds that the state sold in April of 2003 were Garvey bonds.
Are the use of Garvey bond funds restricted to certain uses?
Well, they're for transportation projects. The projects have to be approved by the federal government. I haven't talked with DOT about future Garvey bonds for projects that they have.
Somebody offhand the transportation, governor's transportation capital budget. What is it? How many millions of dollars is it?
I'm not aware that there are any Garvey bonds.
No, not Garvey. That's the transportation budget.
Simply the budget number.
Is it 400 million? What do you mean? I don't know.
I'm sorry, I don't know.
Okay, well, let's not go into it.
Give or take a couple mil.
Mr. Chairman, we'll check those numbers out and get back to Representative Roquebert.
Thanks.
I have two questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Once again, on January 25, how much was involved?
Well, the amount that we finally did issue upon seeing the bids was $25,725,000 even.
Okay, and my second question through the chair, if I may. You mentioned the difference between the state issuing bonds and municipalities issuing bonds.
Yes.
What are the advantages and disadvantages of both?
Well, for state debt, frankly, I'm not aware of an advantage in having the municipality be the issuer. For state debt,
I'm talking about specifically, for example, school construction.
Well, municipalities issue their own debt for their own school construction as is proper for their own projects. Occasionally, the state has used municipalities to be the issuer of its own lease debt.
Thank you.
Thanks. Any further questions, Representative Seaton?
Yeah, I do it. There was $25 million issued. Did you say there was a capital amount of $72 million in those?
Well, state lease debt outstanding last June 30 was $72 million.
Oh, that was a total, not?
Yes, lease debt.
These public purpose projects that you identified related to the bond sale, I know that the debate occurred last session on these kind of projects that the legislature agreed to have them done, but was it agreed that they would be done through bond sales, or was it why the bond sale related to these specific projects you enumerated?
Well, these are projects from quite some time ago. For instance, I know the forestry facility was done in '97 because it was associated with a different part of that. These are projects that have been outstanding for quite some time, and lower interest rates allowed a refinancing, and we waited until they became callable because that's more efficient than doing a so-called advance refunding. And also because the Internal Revenue Code puts restrictions on advance refunding.
Now, the legislature, at least the House last year, passed a bill that had a number of projects in it that the House believed were important and identified bonding as the source of financing for those projects. Science Lab, I think, at the University in Anchorage, and a number of other facilities. The administration had given the legislature a signal that it was not interested in issuing additional debt until some of the things were dealt with, like percent of market value. Is there, if the House were to introduce and pass another bill identifying the projects that it believed were important and wanted those projects constructed through the use of bond sales, is the administration averse to bond sales this year because of the very reasons you indicated you've sold these last ones?
Well, I'll sure, certainly defer to the commissioner if I if I misphrase something. The governor has committed to the credit rating agencies a number of occasions and continues to commit to them that there'll be no new general fund debt until recurring revenues match expenditures. And to the credit rating agencies, that phrase, recurring revenues match expenditures, is code for a fiscal plan. That said, the credit rating agencies know this is a big government with billions of dollars coming in and going out. And from time to time, there are small general fund projects that where the need is great. And so certainly, we talk with the rating agencies in these terms. We say we expect that from time to time we'll have projects that will be able to get in under the wire, so you won't slap our hand, despite the fact that we don't yet have a fiscal plan in place. And so, for instance, I've heard discussions about lease debt for a virology lab of $22.4 million is the number that I think I remember. And that qualifies for getting under the wire. It's a very subjective kind of thing. If we were talking to the rating agencies about a much greater lease debt, then I'm sure that that would be run counter to the discussions that we've had with them up to now about general fund debt versus a fiscal plan.
So the answer basically is maybe. Representative Seaton.
The State Bond Committee, is it involved in the student loan bonds that were sold? Do those go through, or is that totally handled by basically separate corporations?
The State Bond Committee does not issue the student loan corporation bonds. The State Bond Committee does lease debt. It does the International Airport Revenue Bonds and, of course, general obligation bonds.
Representative Wilson, then Representative Greenberg. Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Joe Green, me.
I just want to go back to what you said a little bit ago and just make sure I'm very clear on what your intent was. Are you saying that really for the credit rating of the state, it is wiser for us to have a fiscal plan in place before we start looking at any other kind of bonding or something like that?
That's absolutely true, and Representative Wilson, through the chair. And as a matter of fact, you can read into what the credit rating agencies write that our current credit ratings really anticipate, or if you will, discount. They believe they give us a rating as if a fiscal plan was already in place, because they believe that the state has quite a few options, quite a bit of flexibility, and that it's imminent that a fiscal plan will have to be adopted. And so, if you will, our credit ratings more or less already give us credit for a fiscal plan being in place, even though clearly there is not a plan that matches recurring revenues with expenditures.
Thank you.
Back to square, and that's where we were.
Mr. Chairman, are we ready to move on?
Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Just one final question here on this issue. Mr. Bouton, could you tell me if our bond rating would be affected were the legislature and the people of the state of Alaska to adopt a balanced budget constitutional amendment? Do you think they would have any, give you any traction with their rating analysts?
Well, that I guess the best answer is the rating analysts and the credit rating agencies they work for would have to read that and see. The first concern that a credit rating analyst has about some kind of a balanced budget plan is to see if they think it restricts flexibility so much that debt service or needed services couldn't be met. And so that would be the first review they would make of that sort of thing. And so if you ask them, they would say, well, we'd have to look at it before we could opine. Rating analysts like to see ongoing expenditures met with regular recurring revenues. They don't like to see ongoing needed expenditures met with one-time sources of cash.
Mr. Chairman, I just would say for the record, sir, that you can find me whatever you wish to do for overt and blatant lobbying and advertising here on behalf of my resolution.
There's nothing else. We will move on.
Mr. Chairman, next is Dan Dickinson, Director of the Tax Division, who's going to give us an overview on our existing oil and gas tax structure. Dan?
Thank you. thank you, Commissioner. I want to thank the Chairman and the members of the committee. Clearly, I hope you have about a 10-page handout that we put together, the presentation to the Ways and Means Committee for January 28th.
We do have that. Mr.
I beg your pardon. Yes, Mr. Dickinson, we do.
Thank you very much. Really, what I'd like to do, turning to the first page of that, is just sort of talk about the four boxes there quickly. And I think I'll focus on one of them. But I think what I've heard is that you folks at later dates would like to hear about the other boxes. But if you think about the general fund unrestricted revenue last year, there was about fiscal year 2004. There was about $2.4 billion in and about $2.4 billion out. I was just looking at the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, and they said that the draw on the CBRF last year was for $5 million. So essentially, it was a break-even year. if you want to break that $2.4 billion down, what I've done here is on the first row, looked at the oil and gas revenues that flowed into that number. We have three tax types that are the responsibility of this division, property tax, production tax, and the oil and gas income tax, and that brought in about $1 billion last year. The Department of Natural Resources and the Division of Oil and Gas in particular administers the oil and gas royalties program. That brought in about $1.1 billion. So the oil and gas, the four oil and gas revenue sources, brought in $2.1 billion in the general fund unrestricted revenues.
Mr. Dickinson?
Yes, sir, Mr. Chairman.
What we'll do is we interrupt you from time to time when the committee has questions.
Please do.
So I'm going to yell at you if you don't stop, not to be rude, just to get your attention.
I appreciate that. This is sometimes difficult over the phone.
I understand. And then Representative Groomberg.
Just one question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dickinson, through the chair, is it normal that the oil and gas three types of tax just about equal the royalties?
Mr. Chairman, or Representative Roper through the chair, Grunberg, excuse me, through the chair. No, it isn't. That's really coincidental. What's happened to two effects? The property tax is fairly insensitive to price, so it's sort of a trucks along, if you will. The severance taxes or production taxes have fallen dramatically. If you go back 10 years ago, production taxes were higher than royalties. We got more in production taxes, and you might look at that and say, well, yeah, there's a 15% tax rate, so that makes sense. You'd expect more than a 12.5% royalty. But the effects of the ELF over time have made it so that the production tax is now about one-half of the royalty. I'll footnote that, again, if you take the total royalty, including the money that goes into the permanent fund that's not on this chart, for example, in fiscal year 2004, you'd have about $1.4 billion in royalties and about $700 million in production taxes. The income tax, because we look at worldwide income, tends to fluctuate dramatically depending on events, not just in Alaska, but worldwide. Brett Fried, who is there with you today, has done some modeling, which I'm sure he'd love to talk about in more detail. But fundamentally, what some of his modeling shows is the refining margins, which are a very important aspect of our three largest income taxpayers, have been what's driving income taxes over the last several years.
But Mr. Dickinson, and maybe Mr. Fried is the one to address this, that your chart on page 3 shows a very static property tax revenue, and it appears from the chart at least, maybe just based on your assumptions, a very static corporate income tax revenue.
Mr. Chairman, the property tax, in fact, is fairly static. Basically, the increased investments that are occurring are just about offset by the depreciation of the assets in place. So even though the underlying base may be changing, in fact, there are not dramatic changes here. Obviously, we do not have a ANWR or a gas line built into here, but if you did in the years 2011, 2012, as production started to ramp up in those areas, you would see dramatic increases in the property taxes. If I might, I will defer to Brett to talk about the income tax projections.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah, Mr. Fried.
If you look at if you sort of look at it in terms of what happened in the past, you see that they're actually highly volatile. But when you're forecasting out on the future and you're looking at the price, you know, the same flat price and a flat refinery margin, it's going to look, you know, very static. In reality, it's going to be much more volatile than that.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might add, looking at that chart, what you do see is there is a shrinking royalty and an even more dramatically shrinking production tax.
All right. Okay, thank you.
Going back to the first slide there, the oil and gas taxes constitute $2.1 billion. The next row, and I've got math teachers that would slap my wrist for doing this, but I've shifted decimal points on you just so we can still focus on what we're looking at. The tax division has responsibility for 19 tax types and fees that come to $142.1 million, and those include fisheries taxes, corporate income taxes, non-oil and gas, the sin taxes we talked about earlier, many types, the tire taxes, the things that the commissioner talked about earlier. The middle box on the lower row is $165 million in general fund revenues that are not administered by the tax division. They include the one tax type we don't administer, all the fees, charges, investments, earnings, fines, things like that. And again, we think that the two of these together yield about $300 million. And as the commissioner suggested, we would love to take time and come and talk to you. And Brett Fried spent a lot of time looking at all of these, talk to you about what those are. But today, what I would like to do is focus on the top line.
Go ahead.
If I can turn to the next page, and I guess some folks have turned ahead already, what you'll see is simply a forecast over the next 10 years. The point I would like to make, and I think Brett's made already, is this is sort of the average, our average expectation. We certainly don't expect it to look that cleanly, but I think it does say, all things being equal, this is what we believe the average production and average prices will yield, and in fact, you will see a decline built in there. If I can turn to the next page.
Representative Roper.
Certainly.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Dickinson, all things being equal, these numbers are based on the current structures, and do they include the administrative order at all or not? They're prior to?
Representative Roper, through the chair, they do not include the administrative order. This would be what you would find in the fall 2004 revenue sources book.
Mr. Chairman.
But later, I think the slide that Commissioner Corbis used, there was a breakout of the effects of the administrative order. It was a thin skin on top of the December 2004 revenue sources book.
Mr. Chairman, I just might say for the record, it might be helpful for this committee and other presentations. This is a good graph, but it might be really interesting to go back to, say, circa 1986 or something, to see what the various relationships between production taxes and other tax forms have been historically, as well as you've shown your trend projections here, but maybe looking backwards might give a better perspective to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, if I might refer you to our sources book, if you look at page 85, the appendix, an appendix entitled Historical Petroleum Revenue, you will see that set going back to 1978. That's because what fits on one page, we actually can take you all the way back, as the next slide will, into the days when Cook Inlet was our major source. I might take you to the next graph, which simply shows Alaska oil production. And I think this is I know those of you who have seen me present before, I always try to get this graph into every presentation I give, because I think it just is one that folks need to look at and understand and bring to it, help inform any discussion of oil and gas taxes. The large orange area represents the flow of oil that came from Prudhoe Bay. It was a supergiant. It dominated the entire North Slope for many years. Just to give it perspective, the slightly darker orange skin right above it is the second largest oil field in the United States. So that just puts the sort of the size and the impact of Prudhoe Bay in perspective. What is happening as you move from actual to projected is you see lots and lots of little skins. In fact, to make this graph sensible, we just sort of footnote them as other and don't try to parse them out here. But a lot of these are the kinds of initiatives that the governor is pushed, looking for exploration initiatives, looking for work on the Alaska Peninsula. ANWR would be a dramatic part. It's not part of this, but, you know, would be part of that. So the point I want to make on this graph, and I think it's very important, is as we think about the world, we need to be thinking about the lots of little pieces that we'll continue to have to rely on, and not necessarily try to restore Prudhoe Bay. We'd all love to find another one. The USGS has certainly said that possibility exists in ANWR, but it would be wrong to be counting on it. This graph is fairly straightforward. What I'd like to do is turn, if I could, to the next graph, because I think it starts to put a specific discussion of our tax revenues in perspective. Even when volumes are fairly constant, of course, as price moves around, the revenues move around as well. And many of you are familiar with events that have occurred here when we've had sudden price falls or dramatic price rises. But the point I really want to take away from this graph is when we do nice, smooth projections like we do off to the right here and say, here's what we expect, that's only the average of what we expect. In fact, when we occupy that area, it's going to have dramatic ups and downs. I suppose the takeaway message is, though, is that we expect the ups to be not quite as high, and the downs to approach the zero point, if you will, more closely. So let me proceed now to talk about the various oil and gas taxes. Starting on this next page is a presentation that I gave some time ago when the governor asked about 20 independents and companies that were active investors worldwide to come to Juneau, and the folks from the Department of Natural Resources, AOGCC, and folks from the Department of Revenue spent a day with them and tried to explain to them the structure of how our tax system worked. The emphasis in this will be on exploration, since that's what most of those folks were, but I'd certainly like to clarify that and help bring in the other parts and pieces. The first tax that I'd like to talk about is the property tax. It's a 20 mil tax, in other words, 2% of the assessed value every year. There is then a credit for that against any local assessment. So insofar as the jurisdiction, primarily Valdez, the North Slope Borough, the Fairbanks and North Star Borough, and Kenai, if those jurisdictions have a local assessment, then they dollar for dollar reduce the state's take from the property tax. Nonetheless, the state is still responsible for assessing the entire amount, determining the entire value. There are three different sets of rules, one for exploration property, one for production property, and one for pipelines. The thing you see here is the assessment for exploration property. There are different rules for the other assets. What we have been trying to do is bring, for the production assets, we have tried to focus on valuing, taking asset valuations and have them relating to throughputs so that producers or taxpayers can better understand and have sort of a direct and quantifiable measurement that we can look at. And if production falls, we say the value fell of that asset. If production rises, the value is risen. So we are exploring within the range of the statutory and regulatory requirements if we can give a more direct and transparent method of valuing production facilities. The pipeline transportation, right now we are in the process of valuing the Trans-Alaska pipeline. We understand that some of the parties involved have brought in outside experts, and there could be a dispute that arises between the other municipalities through which TAPS runs, the owners of TAPS, and us as to how we assess the value of that.
Representative Grunberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dickinson, is there any type of property in the industry that is not currently taxed?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, there are specific exemptions, such as, for example, office buildings or normal vehicles, and I could go through the list, that are left to local taxation. So, for example, in the North Slope Borough that has a personal property tax, they will tax vehicles like that. But in general, the major assets are all taxed under 4356.
May I follow through? I understand you're talking about like a car, a station wagon, something like that, but I gather the answer with respect to property, personal property that is unique to the industry, that is all within the tax.
Representative Grunberg, through the chair. Yes, and again, folks maybe who sometimes think of personal property, maybe not in the legal sense, something like TAPS is considered personal property in the sense that it's not real property.
Yeah, Representative Roethlisberger.
Mr. Chairman, as much for asking questions, Mr. Dickinson, can you, off the top of your head, inform the committee what the local take mill rates are for those various jurisdictions along TAPS, North Slope Borough, Fairbanks, Valdez, any others?
Certainly, Mr. Representative Roethlisberger, through the chair, what I might try to do is, if folks have our sources book in front of them, rather than have me try to pine off the top of my head, if you turn to the table on page 35, 4.7, table 4.7, that does not have the mill rates, but I think you'll see the effect of those. Valdez is at a 20 mill rate, which means that the state receives no property taxes for the portion of the pipeline and the Valdez Marine Terminal and other associated assets in Valdez. The North Slope Borough has a mill rate of about 18.5, So the state receives about 1.5 mills. That works out to about a 92.5%, North Slope Borough 7.5% for the state. Those two mill rates have stayed fairly constant over time. Since the last few years. Kenai, of course, has a widely differing set of mill rates because you have the peninsula borough and then local towns within it. But those tend to be lower. I believe that they're all under 10 mills. The North Fairbanks and the North Slope, North Star Borough, again, I think are something just above 10. I can look those last two up specifically if you'd like.
Yeah, if you could get to us later, right?
Sure, yeah.
I can do that.
It's amazing.
It's amazing. Yeah. Representative Grimberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under our state law, are municipalities free to adopt any mill rate they wish?
Representative Grimberg, through the chair. They are free to adopt any mill rate they wish up to 30 mills. What I think you will find in practice is they only adopt, 20 becomes an effective cap because below 20, the taxpayer doesn't particularly care because they're going to write a check. It's just more for the municipality, less for the state. The valuation doesn't raise additional dollars. If suddenly a municipality were to go above 20 mills, then you would have, you'll pardon the expression, but real dollars at stake. One other restriction, I think this is very important to understand, is that whatever mill rate is used for personal property, it has to be the same for non-oil and gas and oil and gas. In other words, they can't say oil and gas assets will be taxed at 20 mills, other assets will be at 6 mills. So I think that's effectively the largest, the break, if you will, on mill rates. Supreme Court has even stopped the practice of creating a special service district that included just the pipeline and having a special mill rate for that.
Representative Hooper.
Mr. Chairman, I just hate to say this, but I mean, this is a prime example about the one group that's working currently to work on further production and transportation of our natural resources here, and it just scares the heck out of me because of what their history is. Is it Valdez is 27%? So they are above the 27 mills?
No, excuse me, Mr. Chair. Valdez is at 20 mills, flat.
At 20, okay. Well, they take it all anyway.
And if you have page 35 in front of you, you will see that the gross tax for assets in Valdez was $13.3 million. Local share was $13.3 million. State share is zero.
Where is the mill rate listed in which table?
Mr. Chairman, the mill rates are not listed on table 4.7. The dollars that float as a consequence of those mill rates are. I'm not, but I will get you a list of the mill rates.
All right. Well, we can track. I guess we could just calculate backwards.
Well, I asked him to provide us that.
Okay. Go ahead.
Thank you. Let me move on to the income tax, AS 4320. That is a sliding scale. It is 9.4% over $100,000 in income, and most of the taxpayers we're looking at in the oil and gas taxes are over $100,000 of income. You start with the federal taxable income. And again, this particular slide was focused on folks who would come up here and might, when they first came up, not fall under the oil and gas rules because they would just be exploring. Companies that are not oil and gas, they have a three-factor apportionment. In other words, you would look at their total U.S. income, and then you'd figure out how much was Alaska income by multiplying through by three factors. The first one is property, the second one is payroll, and the third one is sales. Once a company becomes either a producer of oil and gas in the state or an owner of pipeline transportation assets, the payroll factor is removed and their production factor is inserted. And actually, I didn't quite get that right. If they become a producer, then that payroll factor is replaced with a production factor. If they are just a pipeline company, then you just go to the property and the sales. For an oil and gas company, we also look at their worldwide income. So for an integrated oil producer, there might be as many as 400 corporations that fall under that unitary group. We take all that worldwide income, figure out what, you know, figure out a single number, and then we say how much of that business was generated in Alaska. We look at the three factors, multiply through, and come up with a proportion of that worldwide income that we think is Alaskan income, and then multiply that times the 9.4.
There's a lot of information in a short period of time. Just a minute. Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you tell us what percent then, like our three main producers, what percent is Alaska according to their worldwide? Is it pretty low?
Representative Wilson, yeah, I really can't get into specific numbers. I don't know what you would characterize as low, but it is certainly true. And if you, I think, looked at their financial statements, you would find that, you know, the let me just give, for example, a number that President Marshall of BP Alaska used publicly yesterday when he said 1 in 10 barrels of their production comes from Alaska. So that might give you a sense of their the relative percentage.
Thank you.
Moving from the income tax to the production tax, unless there are any other questions, and I apologize for blowing through that very quickly.
Mr. Dickinson? Mr. Dickinson?
Yes.
Just a sec. Representative Roper.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Dickinson, could you make available those particular numbers to the committee? Are they public records? Are they part of any proprietary information on tax returns that that are confidential?
The specific numbers would be confidential. There are ways, of course, under our statute, if legislators sign the appropriate things, we can certainly show those to you in an executive or a closed session. I believe that maybe we could help you look at some of the sort of operating reports or annual financials and get some sense of where those numbers might come out. Some companies, ConocoPhillips, for example, is very explicit about its Alaska holdings. For those of you that are familiar with FASB rules on segment reporting, there is some leeway there, and if you're under 10%, you have the discretion of, you don't need to report something separately, and as a consequence, ConocoPhillips is the one that we consistently find, ConocoPhillips and its predecessors, we consistently find public reporting about Alaska. The other two companies, we do not. The other two large taxpayers, excuse me, we do not.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Dickinson, I appreciate the problem you have, but you're a much better position to use your Ouija board and other public sources of information, because I find myself mystified by FASB rules and so forth. So is there a way that, without causing too much of an effort on your staff's part, that you could provide the committee with some approximations that would be acceptable and wouldn't breach your confidentiality rules, so we could have just a range of ideas about that?
Representative Roper, through the chair, I can certainly look into that, and as you can imagine, over the last 2 weeks, I've spent a lot of time dealing with what precisely is confidential and what isn't, what form it can be released, and so we'll continue that conversation in respect of these.
Good follow-up, Mr. I think it's important. We're going to be discussing this entire tax regime, and to have an understanding about the relative weighing of each particular tax-paying petroleum company in the state and what their real interest is here, and what they have involved in their ability to move capital and make investments here because of their investment here, I think is an important fact that the committee should be aware of. And additionally, Mr. Dickinson, along that same line, I find it helpful sometimes if you could, on the formula for the income tax, if you could provide a relatively simplified example using numbers to show how the tax works, particularly when you make this transition, when you go into the production and delete the payroll and so forth, and what would trigger that. Just using some pro forma example, I think, might be helpful for the committee to understand how the system works.
Yeah, I was going to follow up with that, too. What would be really useful is to show oil coming out of the ground into a pipeline to tidewater, and then what a company's paying on that, whether it's the pipeline company or the oil company, and what, so what, start with the oil, translate that into money, and then what money is being paid out to which jurisdictions, including the state, and track that oil through the line, and which entities are involved in payment. So we get a look not only at, I think many of us in the state look at the pipeline and the oil companies as, and then have, it's easy to picture in our minds where the pipeline is, where the oil is, and where it's going, but it's less understood how much money is being taken out of that product and who's paying the money and what the effect of the tax policies have on that to the, both the state and local entities. So we need to track both the oil and the money coming out based on existing policies, and then how we, if we tinker with them, what sensitivity that's going to have as we have this discussion further on. But we need a good baseline on that so we have a, we can wrap our minds around it. Representative Grunberg, Wilson, and Samuels.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Dickinson, you mentioned that there are some 400 related corporations and I don't know if that referred to simply one company or all of these companies that are caught within the net of the unitary group. I know that this has been a problem that I've discussed with the commissioner last year, companies, non-oil type companies, have used the setting up of licensing arrangements and various other types of things to escape local corporate taxes, and I'm referring specifically to what's called the Jeffrey Giraffe issue with the Toys R Us company. And I am told that because we have the unitary tax concept here, we have generally escaped that problem, although I've had legislation drafted to make sure we don't. In fact, in the oil industry, is there any escape because of sophisticated legal setups of related corporations licensing anything that they've been able to use to get out from under this net?
Representative Grunberg, through the chair, generally the Jeffrey problem, and I can spend some time talking about that if folks want me to clarify that, but the specific Jeffrey problem is one that we do not have. As you've correctly said, we do go out, we identify all the businesses that are part of the unitary group, and the 400 number I was using was a large taxpayer that I'm aware of that I know that the number of corporations that we pulled in was over 400. Of those, probably four or five at the most were doing business in Alaska, but because they're part of the unitary worldwide group, we would go and pull in a subsidiary in Mozambique and a subsidiary in Kazakhstan, et cetera, et cetera. The Jeffrey problem, I mean, basically, if you look at the world, there's sort of the eastern states tend to tax on the corporation basis. The western states, maybe because their tax regimes date from a later date, tend to look at this unitary basis. So that's not a problem. When you look at, the question, are there any ways of avoiding tax? The tax filing of a major corporation, I'll single out Exxon because I believe, last quarter it had the largest, the best results, the highest profit reported by any known, industrial organization in the history of the known universe for quarterly profits. Their tax filings are huge. The federal tax code, as you know, is very complex, and one person's shelter is another person's economic incentive. And so I don't want to say that it's all crystal clear. I don't want to imply to you that we are able to audit the entire every line of it in any sense. Our audits focus on the areas that we've identified in the past. We sometimes bring up new issues and look at new areas, but we simply don't have the person power to go through the thousands of pages, each one with hundreds of lines that constitute a tax return, and then we know we're going to get another one 12 months later for the next period. I believe that we are good. The folks I have, you know, I have great faith in the folks that we have in our ever shrinking corporate tax section that's looking at these areas, and I believe that we consistently raise issues where we find things are not being done. You know, we believe in the, according to the again, ever-changing law. I don't want to imply there's some static set of rules. As you know, we adopt the federal rules by reference, and so every year, again, as you folks are probably aware, the federal tax bills that pass are hundreds of pages long. We get these explanations from places like, you know, Corporate Clearinghouse. There'll be thousands of pages just explaining what happened in that year. Frequently, the changes are retroactive or have effects over many years. So, you know, I think we do an extraordinarily good job. One of the, if I can put a plug in, one of the things that we're looking for in our funding request this year is to have an outside firm come in and evaluate how we do it, compare us to other states. Are there issues we're missing? Are there better ways of looking at some of these things? There has been a lot of focus on corporate income taxes nationally and among the states. And I think the concerns you raise are good ones. I think the specific focus on a Jeffrey-type method versus the unitary is not one of the areas that I personally think should get a lot of focus. Long-winded answer. I apologize, sir.
Did you have a question, Representative Wilson? Representative Samuels?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. At a further hearing, maybe I'd like to know more about the non-oil and gas corporate structure of the fishing industry. How do you allocate, you know, where they actually make their money at, and just interested in how that works. And the real simple question, Alyeska Pipeline Company, is that just considered an Alaskan corporation and pays a tax as if they were a corner grocery store?
Representative Samuels, through the chair, I really can't get into a taxpayer specific, but let me sort of venture some general rules. When you have a joint venture, there are certain rules that can apply. They're what you call pass-through entities. Again, I don't imply that Alyeska is one, but generally, if you look out and see joint ventures or business being conducted in which several corporations own that, generally, or you will tend to see the use of a pass-through structure so that the taxes simply pass through to the owners.
Okay.
If
the tariff goes up, then that profit of the tariff moves on to the company, and then it gets incorporated into the worldwide net income for the five owners, and Alyeska then does not pay corporate income tax.
Again, through the chairman, Mr. Samuels, I don't want to suggest that Alyeska is a JV. If it were a standalone Alaska corporation, then it would pay tax on that. If it were a JV, then typically that would pass through to the owners the way you've just described it.
Okay, thanks.
What was
Mr. Chairman, if I might just, again, on our fall 2002 revenue sources book on page 23, and I realize you don't have that in front of you, but perhaps we can get copies of this for you. We took four different barrels, a typical barrel from Prudhoe Bay, a typical barrel from NPRA, at a high price and a low price, and broke it up into, you know, 15 different pieces about where the dollar that you get for selling that barrel would end up. Fall 02, yes.
Mr. Chairman, we'll get you copies of that portion of the 02 report.
Thank you.
And again, I apologize. I realize that these matters, I'm sort of blowing through them quickly. My thought was to get to the production tax and the economic limit factor. I had a sense folks had some questions on that.
Well, we'll have more time, too. Go ahead.
Okay. Should I proceed with the production tax?
Yes, sir.
Production tax, the next slide, AS 4355. The basic rule is you take 15% non-royalty production, multiply that times the gross value at the wellhead. In other words, if it's valued at $22 a barrel at the wellhead, you multiply that times 22 times the economic limit factor. Before I get to the economic limit factor, let me just explain two other terms on there. The 15% is replaced by 12.25% for the first 5 years of commercial production. What the gross value at the wellhead is you start with the how much the oil it was sold for, and then you subtract from that the transportation cost of the point of production, which typically in our state, of course, will be a sale on the lower 48 on the West Coast or Hawaii. Then you'll subtract from that tankering costs. You'll subtract from that taps. You'll subtract or add from that quality bank. The quality bank is a net zero, but it's how the various oils are commingled and how the owners pay each other to make sure that the lower quality owner who puts oil into taps and then takes a higher quality product out at the other end after it's all been mixed pays the folks whose value was degraded. And then if it's not Prudhoe Bay, the Prudhoe Bay unit, which is, of course, as everyone is aware, is right next to the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, but is either further west, like Kuparuk or Alpine, or further east, like Endicott, you then have the costs to ship the oil through those upstream pipelines. So go back to our basic formula. It's 15% times the non-royalty production times gross value at the wellhead times ELF.
Mr. Dickinson, the portions of that formula, 15 times non-royalty times ELF times gross, this 15%, where is that derived from?
That is in the statute. 15% for, except for the first 5.5 years of production, which is 12.25. That's, I believe, 0111. So, 43, 55, 0111.
So the two policy issues the legislature could have jurisdiction over would be the 15% figure and the ELF. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that you would have jurisdiction over all of the issues there. I believe it was a explicit consideration on the legislator's part to exempt non-royalty production. I don't think there's anything magical about that. There might be a double counting issue, but fundamentally, if we were taxing ourselves, so to speak, insofar as it's state royalty, and the gross value at the wellhead, the legislature supplied us with, nine words. We get to deduct the cost of transportation of the oil or gas, and we've had to write hundreds of pages of regulations to try to figure out what that means or try to clarify what that could mean, and the legislature certainly could step in and expand, contract, further define those amounts. In fact, that's where most of our audit disputes occur now, and there are clearly millions of dollars in which we're trying to interpret what those few words the legislature gave us meant.
Thank you.
Turning to the next page, what is that economic limit factor? It's a factor between 0 and 1. And the theory behind that is production, the certain amount of production is below the economic limit, and what that means is that's the amount of production that a producer needs to cover their costs. And the theory was if you had production below the economic limit, you would have no tax, no production tax on that production. So if you were barely covering, if the production that you need to cover your costs, tax would not be added on to that. And the thesis that you heard a lot was, Alaska is an expensive place to do business, and the production tax should never be the straw that breaks the camel's back. Production tax should never be the added cost that makes production uneconomic. So the theory is you have production below the economic limit, it's not taxed. You have production above the economic limit, then it is taxed. Now, we have certain rules in place. Originally, it was a very simple formula. It was 300 barrels a well, and it was decided that if you had 300 barrels, that would be enough to cover your costs. In fact, you could come in and ask for a different number of barrels. But over the time, the legislature has streamlined that, particularly in 1989. They also added what was called the field size factor. But the theory remains the same. That is a proxy for your costs, for your upstream costs, and if you have production below the economic limit, it is not subject to tax. Production above the economic limit is. What you see on the North Slope now is if you have very big fields, and Prudhoe Bay is the prime example, you have lots of production above the economic limit, very little production below the economic limit. Before this aggregation decision, the economic limit factor of Prudhoe Bay was about 0.85. So what that was saying is 15% of the production was tax-free, was deemed to be production below the economic limit, and 85% was deemed to be production above the economic limit. There are two other fields that have high ELF, and those are Alpine and North Star. And those are not huge fields, but they are very productive fields. And the other thing that goes into the formula besides the field size factor is the amount of oil that is produced per well per day. Both Alpine and North Star produce over 4,000 barrels per well per day. And if you think back to 1977, the legislature wrote the rules, they said, gee, you need to recover 300 barrels in order to recover your cost. When you're producing 4,000 barrels a day, clearly lots of that production is above the economic limit. And so Alpine and North Star both also have ELFs of roughly 0.885. All other fields on the North Slope have an ELF close to zero. Kuparik, Kuparik, second largest oil field in the United States, but its ELF is about 0.1. So again, if you think about this, that formula, it's 15% times 0.1, so Kuparik is paying an effective tax rate of about 1.5% of the wellhead value of its non-royalty oil. So basically, what the ELF is a formula for figuring out what the economic limit for any field or set of wells is. Now, I'm going to actually break from my production from my what the remaining slides here is talking about the exploration tax credits that the governor's encouraged and that you folks voted into place over the last couple of years. I think those are very important, but I see my time is running low, so I do want to focus on the rest of the ELF issue. What the administrative decision that the Department of Revenue took looked at was in the Prudhoe Bay unit, you had the Prudhoe Bay IPA, which stands for the Initial Participating Area, and that, as I said earlier, because it was producing several hundred thousand barrels a day at a very high ELF.
Let me ask.
Surrounding it were...
Mr. Dickinson?
Yes, sir.
Just to cut to the chase on the administrative order, yesterday I had heard a press report the governor made at the Alaska Support Industry Alliance in which there was some statement related that the order would not be applied. Those companies presently producing would be grandfathered out of the application of the administrative order. Is that a change of the administration's policy on the application of the administrative order?
Mr. Chairman, I am not aware of that statement, and I'm going to have to believe that if that was a press report or something, that was not an accurate statement. The current producers are definitely affected by that decision. The state does not really have the ability to choose between taxpayers and say some are affected by it and some are not.
So it's unclear in my mind what the effect of the administrative order is and what the statements made yesterday mean. And there's a lot of questions on this one. We're going to have to take this one up at the next meeting, in which we'll also take up the non-oil tax revenue portion of this program. Can you wrap up just right now, Mr. Dickinson, and then we're going to adjourn, and then we're going to come back to this one, because this, by the time we meet again, the AO will have taken effect, and we'll have some more information, more questions, I think.
Okay, just very briefly, the administrative order simply took some fields who were paying zero ELF, in other words, that the law said needed a lot of help, needed basically all their production in order to cover their costs. We determined that was not the case. The law specifically gives us the authority to aggregate fields together if, in fact, the legislative intent's not being followed and you find situations where the production, we see a lot of production which is above the economic limit, but which the application requested by the producers is below the economic limit, and that's the decision that we made. One other very important point I want to make is that when a producer is going to create a development, they can come and, under our regulations, can apply to the Department of Revenue, say we'd like to get an advance ruling on the tax treatment. We issue that, and I think it's very important to say that this decision did not affect any of our advance ruling letters. think the governor was very firm yesterday in saying that we don't intend to affect any of those. We're not going back on any promises that we've made and that the industry has relied on. Okay. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I guess I'll conclude my remarks.
Okay, and then within the next 2 weeks, we will have a bill to start to coalesce some of these things around before us. We're adjourned.